This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. You were born outside the U.S., and you went to medical school outside this country, too. But when you got here, you aced all the tests American medical students have to pass before becoming doctors. Should we mandate additional requirements from you before you get to practice medicine? Two Virginia researchers who've been looking at that question say what they've discovered is both a public health issue and an immigration one. But in this case, the immigration aspects are not at the federal level. Instead, they're being handled, sometimes in fairly bizarre ways, by each of the 50 states. The new research by political scientists David LeBlanc and Sonal Pandya sheds light on concerns most of us have never really considered. But since their findings could affect medical professionals here in Virginia and across the country, we figured we ought to hear more. So we will, right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. If you went to see a doctor who was born outside the U.S. and had attended medical school outside the U.S., would you feel reassured to know that that physician had gone through requirements and training beyond what American doctors had had to do? Well, apparently the state of Virginia and a couple dozen other states feel that you would. And that is our focus this hour. So if you have thoughts about the intersection of medicine, immigration, and economics, you're welcome to join the conversation at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Our guests are both political scientists from the University of Virginia. The new report they have co-authored is titled Doctors with Borders. Sonal Pandya and David LeBlanc, thank you both for making time for us.
Thanks for having us here, Tom.
Thank you for having us.
Well, David, let me turn to you first, if I might. What is the point of this research on immigration and on medicine?
What motivated us in starting this project was a real interest in thinking about high-skilled migration into the United States and how countries compete for those individuals that have skills that are in need. And as we started to drill down into our research, we found that there were policies and barriers, if you will, that are not made by the national government. So the current immigration debate today focusing on amnesty and visas, et cetera, really is a debate about who gets into the country. What we found in our work is that it's not so much of who gets in, but who can practice. That is to say, who can enter the labor market. Decisions about who can enter a labor market are made when we're thinking about skilled professionals. A lot of those decisions are made at the state level. So states differ in the requirements they have for physicians and whether foreign trained physicians have to pass a higher hurdle or have a different standard than domestically trained physicians. And what we found quite startlingly is not only do states differ in terms of the requirements for foreign trained physicians, but that these requirements have a dramatic effect on the number of physicians that are available to serve across states. And we really thought it was really quite interesting because while all the debate about immigration is happening at the national level, the things that impact citizens on a day-to-day basis are things are policies that are made at the state level.
I'd add to that these are generally unelected state regulators who are making policies, not just with regard to physician licensing, but across a variety of professions, engineers, nurses, lawyers. And so it's the decision of these unelected state regulators that determines how easily these really crucial skills can flow across national borders.
Sonia, walk me through some of the basics here, if you could. What is it that the states are doing that is different for somebody who is a native of a different country, who went to medical school in a different country, than what they're doing for anybody who goes to medical school in the U.S. before these would-be physicians can actually become physicians in the U.S.
So I should add, just in terms of the terminology, when we refer to international medical graduates, we're referring to everybody who went to medical school outside of the United States. So that does include some U.S. permanent residents and citizens who have received their medical education abroad. And so the laws typically distinguish between those educated abroad and those educated domestically. And the real variation across states in terms of licensure regulations comes in terms of residency training. So physicians go through medical school, receive a medical degree. All states require physicians to complete a residency. So this is a very highly structured system of postgraduate training for physicians that varies in length from anywhere from 3 years to 5+ years, depending on the medical specialty.
Do I understand that all of these medical students, whether educated abroad or here in the U.S., even before they get to the residency component, have to pass some tests?
Yeah, there's actually a pretty rigorous screening process. So the U.S. medical licensing exam consists of three parts. And if you look at the pass rates, you compare the pass rates for those educated out of the U.S. and domestic medical graduates, we find that at each of these tests, at each of these levels, the pass rates are systematically lower for international medical graduates. On some of them, the difference is as much as 20-30%. So there's a significant amount of screening going on in these exams. So they have to complete two of these exams in order to be even eligible to enter what's called the National Residency Match. This is a centralized system by which medical graduates are assigned to these graduate postgraduate training positions.
So what your study is finding doesn't have anything really to do with these tests, that the tests are not in any way structured differently for international students
than
for U.S. medical students. What your argument is after somebody has done well on these tests, how their future and the hoops they have to jump through to become a licensed physician is different based on whether you went to medical school outside or inside the U.S.
Yeah, so there's some pretty significant quality screening. And that's, of course, the obvious concern and justification for licensing regulations. Lay people are not equipped to know to assess the skills of a physician and whether they're competent to do their job. And so not only are there these exams, but this residency matching program, only about 40% of international medical graduates actually successfully get a position. So then there's quite a bit of quality screening going on at that level as well. And so where we pick up the story is these international medical graduates who have passed all three of these exams, who have successfully secured a residency training position in the United States. At that point, we see quite a bit of variation across states in the hurdles they have to jump through in order to get a license. So even at that point, there are states who are discriminating against foreigners.
Yeah, and it's not any different than when we think about discrimination across products, right, or across different sorts of commodities based upon national origin, right? So if you have to pay more for a Toyota than you have to pay for a Ford, because one is manufactured abroad, what we find is that there is similar kind of discrimination, not based on the quality of the physician, but simply based upon where that physician was trained. Because the quality control, as Sonal mentioned, quality control has already been taken into account with regard to these three very rigorous tests that have been administered, and again, you have to pass in order to even qualify for a residency.
So what it gets down to, David LeBlanc, is after you've gone through all these other hurdles that basically you've been treated up to this point equally, whether you went to medical school in the U.S. or somewhere else in the world, when it comes to state licensing, a doctor who needed 1 year of residency before becoming a general practitioner if he was a U.S. medical student, in the same state, if he came from a medical school in India or England or Africa, he would need twice as long, three times as long, or more of a residency before he could be licensed?
That's correct. I think the maximum is three times as much, at least today, right? And what we find in this paper and through this project is that there are differences in these requirements that are a function of what the state medical licensing board looks like, whether that board is appointed or elected. And then the consequence of that difference is that the longer the residency requirement, the less likely it is that you will have as many foreign-trained medical professionals in a particular state. And the public policy consequence of that is, well, it should be obvious, right? That states that have higher barriers for foreign-trained medical professionals, international medical professionals, those states are going to have an undersupply of physicians, which means that there is going to be a larger proportion of their population that is what's called underserved, that there is not enough medical resources for the population that currently exists and that needs or demands medical attention in these areas.
This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, political scientist Sonal Pandya and David LeBlanc, both from the University of Virginia, are our guests. One of the reasons we're looking at this new research of theirs is because it has to do with whether or not we have enough doctors in the U.S., as well as how it reflects on immigration policy at a time when immigration is certainly an issue many people are paying attention to. So if you have thoughts about what you're hearing, you're certainly welcome to join us at 888-WMRA-TALK. But Sonal, how much difference is this making in whether or not there are enough doctors in any given state?
Well, to give you a sense, about 25% of all practicing physicians in the United States were trained abroad. That's quite a large number, even given these higher hurdles that they have to surpass to receive a license. You couple that with the fact that we are on the eve of major healthcare reform, even now, even before health reform has taken place, we suffer from enormous physician shortages. Approximately 20% of the U.S. population is in what is a federally designated area that suffers from a health professional shortage of primary care providers. What happens when we add about 30 million more people to the mix?
Who suddenly have health care.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So if you think of all of the options there are to address this the supply of physicians, this seems like one of the easier things to do, one of the things that could remedy the situation faster than, say, building more medical schools, which is happening, but probably isn't going to meet our needs soon enough.
One of the arguments that you're making in this new study is if people who have to jump all through the same number of hurdles up to number of years of residency, whether they're trained outside the U.S. or inside the U.S., if the years of residency were the same for both groups of students, about half of the U.S. would suddenly solve its physician shortage problem?
Yes.
Half of all states.
Half of all states. And that's a yes, but with qualification.
Well, tell us about qualifications. Good. I love qualifications.
Right. In some cases, our analysis shows that a state like California, for example, would almost instantly increase the number of medical professionals it had dramatically and would have an oversupply of medical professionals. The reasons why I said the answer is qualified is because we don't know whether they would all stay or they would all go. We don't know what the circulation of medical professionals would look like. Whereas there are a number of states in the South, especially in the Deep South, that even if you change the requirements, our analysis shows that you're not going to structurally change the fact that these states are medically underserved, right? So that's the qualification.
You're listening to the music, so you're wanting to jump in, but you're thinking that there's not going to be enough time, Sonal? Okay, well, I can take that.
Just to give some specific
actually,
numbers.
Actually, I chatted long enough now that we are going to go to the break anyway. So I apologize for that. But I promise to give you a chance to complete your thought. And Diane in Timberville looks like she's going to be our first caller when we get back in just a bit more than 1 minute. David LeBlanc is the J. Wilson Newman Professor of Governance at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, as well as chair of the university's Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics. Sonal Pandya is a faculty member in that politics department. Both are among the researchers who have produced a new report titled Doctors with Borders. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Let's go next to Timberville. Diane, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
It's a comment, and I think that with students that are educated in our country, we're familiar with their education, and therefore they don't need more than a year's residency. When you have students educated abroad, we're not familiar with all the different countries' education and therefore don't know whether they've covered all the things that our physicians have. Also, I don't think you can say there are too many doctors. You know, that's something we can do here. You know, if you go into business for yourself, then you make it or you don't. Or if you're under the umbrella of a larger entity, I don't know, it's just something that happens. You know, you go into business doing anything. If there's a market for it, then fine.
Yeah, Diane, I think that your first point is, I think, the natural reaction to the sorts of things that Sonal and I and Britton Peterson, our student, finds in this paper. The one part, though, where we differ is that, as Sonal said at the beginning of this program, all medical students have to pass a number of tests before they even get a residency slot. And those tests are the way that we know how well they are trained. It's just like, if students that are trained in Utah or in California or Wyoming or Colorado get a residency in Virginia, it's not clear that we know what they're taught at any of those medical schools. We assume, we hope, that the tests that they take is going to be sufficient to sort out those who know the material from those who don't know the material.
All right. I must have missed that earlier on in the show, but go ahead.
To respond to the second part of your question in terms of sort of supply will meet demand, is that, if I got it correctly?
Yeah.
So in the case of physicians and licensed occupations, that's actually not the case, particularly for physicians. So what regulates the supply, or what determines the supply of physicians in the United States? So independent of physicians coming from abroad, we have a fixed number of medical schools that have a fixed capacity. Certainly we can build more, but that takes time.
So it's a little bit different than if I want to become a plumber, there's a good chance I can find an education that'll get me into that career.
Right.
That's correct.
Right. And then on top of that, as we described, this residency program that's required of all states for physicians to complete as a condition of licensure, that's where the real bottleneck in physician supply is in the United States. So these are generally federally funded graduate training programs, and the number has been frozen since 1997. Congress cut funding, or sort of froze funding, for the residency programs. So even if you manage to get into medical school, finding a residency slot is a non-trivial barrier to actually, you know, becoming a physician, setting up shop on your own.
Yeah. Diane, such great questions. Thank you so much for joining us. For you listening, if you have thoughts about the intersection between immigration and medicine in the U.S., you're welcome to join in, too, at 888-WMRA. Talk in all numbers. That's 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you're welcome to post on the Virginia Insight Facebook page, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Next, we're going to Harrisonburg. Aaron, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Hi. My name is Aaron. This is a two-part question.
Well, good.
The first part is, you've addressed medical students coming from abroad to America. Is an American physician's license, is that applicable to other countries? Could I go to medical school and then practice in Europe or New Zealand or something like that, having gone to medical school in America? And then the second part question is, how closely related are these medical studies to, say, pharmaceutical studies? Could I become a pharmacist, study in America, and then go abroad and practice in, you know, Europe, New Zealand, Africa, wherever I wanted to go?
So to answer the first part of your question, the only country where you could sort of do that would be Canada. So Canada is the one exception to these licensure regulations. There's generally recognition of Canadian medical credentials in the United States and vice versa. But aside from that, you would probably have to go through a similar procedure and start your training from scratch, say you were to go to England with your American medical education.
And Aaron, with regard to your second question, while the medical profession and being trained as a pharmacist, they are related. One would still need to get certification, even in the United States, to become a pharmacist, even if you had your medical degree. Certainly, some of the work that you had done, some of the education that you had done, would be transferable, but you'd still need to become certified in order to gain access to that professional association, to get that credential, and then ultimately to be hired in the United States. And the same would be the case if you went if you worked abroad.
To consider this in a larger context, so if you take engineers, engineers have to be licensed in the same way that we've been describing. There's actually quite a bit of recognition across countries of engineering credentials. So about 20 countries, their national the National Association of Electrical Engineers, Civil Engineers, they mutually recognize each other's qualifications. And that's also consistent with the licensure process here. So in contrast to the physicians, if you're a foreign trained engineer and you want to come to the U.S. and practice engineering, you take a test. And it's the same test that Americans take. You pass the test, you get the license. So there isn't nearly the kind of barrier to entering the U.S. market for, say, engineers as there is for physicians.
Aaron, if I may, I'd like to pick up on a possible offshoot of your question. Aaron talking about doctors who are trained in the U.S., going to practice elsewhere in the world. It seems to me, David LeBlanc and Sonia Pandya, that what you found in this new study is that after students, wherever they are trained, basically prove that they are equivalent in knowledge and ability because they have to pass these three rigorous tests before they can even begin to compete to find residencies, that then the rub in the U.S. becomes that if you were trained outside the United States, your years of residency are going to have to be much longer to meet the requirements of many states than if you were a U.S. medical student. Is there something similar going on in other countries? I mean, if I graduated from medical school in Colorado and I decided I wanted to live and practice in England, would I have to be at a residency in England longer than if I went to a medical school in England to begin with? Do you know?
Offhand, I don't know exactly what the disparity would be as compared to those trained domestically in England. What's interesting internationally is, so if you take the European Union, the EU is easily the most ambitious economic integration project in between sovereign countries in the past century. And this has been a real sticking point for them. So Germans don't want to recognize Portuguese medical credentials. Brits don't want to recognize Spanish accounting credentials. Mm-hmm. And so despite the fact they have a fully integrated market for goods, for service, for many services, for the movement of investment, there still remain substantial barriers, even within the European Union, to move and practice your profession.
Aaron, great questions. Thanks so much for joining us. So for you who are listening, let's put you on the spot here for a moment. Have you ever had a medical consultation with a doctor who seemed to have not been a native-born American? How'd you feel about that at the time? If the first time that happened was long ago, do you feel any different about it today than you did back then? 888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember our phone number. In all numbers, it's 888-967-2825. You can also post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page. We're going next to Concord, North Carolina. Jennifer, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for the two professors is, have they studied or considered the use of mid-level providers like PAs or nurse practitioners in the underserved areas as opposed to potentially fast-tracking foreign medical graduates who are MDs who may not be as highly trained as American medical graduates? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you. Jennifer, I guess it's a shame you're taking the answer
off
the air.
Well, actually, I think she's still here. Jennifer, do you want to?
Oh, sure.
Because I'm curious about the last part of your question.
Uh-huh.
It may be the case that other professionals have different kinds of training.
Mm-hmm.
In our project, we are not making a comparison between the training of nurse practitioners or registered nurses versus physicians. We're simply comparing physicians that are trained in different countries. What is suggestive in our work, and certainly not directly addressed, and I think Sonal alluded to this earlier, is that there are a variety of other ways that states can go about trying to deal with the problem of under-provision of health care. Part of that might be California, again, is a very good example. California looking at ways in which registered nurses can expand their ability to write prescriptions and to serve to provide the kind of services that MDs have traditionally served. This is, as you might guess, because of the dramatic size of the underserved population in California. And it certainly wouldn't surprise me if that practice expands outside of California. I guess what I would also react to is that I don't know, and it's certainly not part of our work to know the differences in terms of training or expertise or ability between these different professions. You know,
but one of the arguments it seems like you're making is that if you, in essence, are comparing oranges to oranges.
That's correct.
You have a doctor who was trained in South Africa at a medical school there. He passes all of the tests that he has to pass in the U.S., same as a student at a medical school anywhere in the United States. Then why should that doctor from South Africa, you say, have to do more years of residency than the doctor who was trained in the U.S.
Right, that's precisely right. And it very well may be, as I think Jennifer is suggesting, that there are other medical professionals that have training that is similar to that of MDs. Right. But that's a whole different discussion insofar as thinking about the extent to which nurse practitioners or registered nurses or others can practice in the same way that MDs can. I mean, now we're really talking about opening up and expanding licensing a great deal. And I'm not opposed to that conversation, but that's something that's very different than what we are talking about in this particular project.
Jennifer, have we addressed your question?
Yes, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling.
It. Okay, thank you very much.
Phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Political scientist Sonal Pandya and David LeBlanc, both from the University of Virginia, are our guests. Next, let's go to Dayton. Lauren, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And Tom just kind of touched on my concern, and that is, while I have a great respect for the long history of standardization of medical education and making sure that all the physicians know exactly what they need to know and they all know the same things, I have a great respect for that, but my concern is that the policy of making immigrants jump through additional hoops when they've already demonstrated competencies that American students demonstrate, it just seems like blatant discrimination in my eyes, and that if the need for additional residency is to understand cultural competency of where you're ending up or maybe understanding a different healthcare delivery system, that I understand, but I don't think that should take 3, 4, 5, 6 years of residency.
What's so interesting is not just the fact that these regulations exist that require lengthier training for foreigners, but that there's variation across states in the United States. So we all can appreciate the big public interest justifications for having physician licensure requirements. But are the standards for safety so different across the 50 states that they would impose different regulations? it does seem to point to the explanation that we provide in our research, that this is a concern about labor market competition within states, within sort of the medical profession. And I should say, we focus on the medical profession simply because this highly structured system of training that we described, it allows us to distinguish between the legitimate public safety concerns and these concerns about protectionism, rent-seeking, which is a sort of perennial problem for economists who are studying occupational licensing. How do you disentangle the two? Because there is obviously justification for
regulations. If I'm remembering or if I took notes correctly in what I read of your report, it seems to me that states that do not do what we're talking about, in other words, states where whether you're trained somewhere else in the world or here in the U.S., once you have passed those tests, it's equivalent number of years of residency, no matter where your training started. Among the states that do it on that equivalent basis are Connecticut, Michigan, New Jersey, Kentucky, and Wyoming. And apparently in those states, they have less of a problem with doctor shortages than all those other states who do discriminate.
I don't know that we can make such a blanket statement, right? So licensure regulations are one consideration for a physician from outside the U.S. in deciding where to settle, where to practice.
I should mention also that what I recall of your study is that Virginia and all of the states bordering on Virginia do have extra years of residency for people who are trained outside the U.S. But it sounds to me, Lauren, like what I'm hearing from our guests is it's not necessarily discrimination against people because they're from another part of the world. It's discrimination because doctors who control the borders in different states feel like they can make more money if they keep more people out.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right way to characterize it. We wouldn't want to when we use the word discrimination. It's not in the context that it's so often used with regard to race or ethnicity, where you're targeting a specific race or ethnic group. Here we use discrimination to simply say that one group is favored over another. And in this case, Tom, as you rightly pointed out, the logic in our argument is that physicians, because licensing is a requirement for entry, physicians want to protect themselves. Right. They want to make sure that the barriers are high to protect membership in this club. Right. Just like any of us who join a club, you know, think it's special to be a member of the club, both because we're in it and because other people are out of it. Right.
But and they control the licensing boards in the states that do this.
In most of these cases, they control the licensing board.
But they also seem to feel like they can make more money if there's less competition.
Well, that's our conjecture. Right. We don't know.
You didn't ask.
We didn't ask. We didn't interview. We did not interview anybody. I doubt
you just
that
looked at the numbers.
I doubt that if we ask somebody and said, gosh, are you doing this so that you can make higher wages?
But it was
we would be surprised if they would say yes. That's exactly why we did it.
That it was the states where doctors controlled the licensing boards. This is where you found this phenomena going on.
That is the conclusion that we reached in
our paper. In the states where they were not controlling the licensing boards, this phenomenon was not going on. So that's a hint. Lauren, yeah. Such great questions. Thank you so much. We're going to continue here on Virginia Insight in just a bit more than 1 minute. Gabriella and Joe on the phone lines, we're going to be getting to you both soon. Originally from Hercules, California, Sonal Pandya is, in both age and experience, a few years behind her boss, former Floridian David LeBlanc, who's chair of the politics department at the University of Virginia. But in addition to this new report that they have co-authored, Sonal and David have at least one other thing in common. In high school, they each were debating team champions. Don't know if they even knew that about each other before today, but we should mention that the full title of their new study is Doctors with Borders, Occupational Licensing as an Implicit Barrier to High-Skill Immigration. By the way, a link to that study can be found on the Virginia Insight page at WMRA.org.
Yeah,
This is Virginia Insight. Oh. I'm Tom Graham, and I made a mistake already.
Sorry? No. Yes, you did make a mistake that I have to correct. I am not Sonal's boss.
I thought you were chair of the department.
I am chair of the department, but that makes me...
But a chair is not somebody's boss?
You know, we can have all kinds of discussions about that. You can ask any of my colleagues.
I stepped on a university political landmine.
I was going to say, you know...
So I'm going to avoid that just by going to Gabriella next in Hampton, Sydney. Gabriella, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering about shortages of doctors in other countries and whether admitting more doctors might not exacerbate those shortages. And then my other question is, I wonder how medical schools in the Caribbean fit into this picture. These are medical schools that American students attend who are not able to get into medical schools in the U.S., and generally their curricula are exactly the same as U.S. medical schools.
Gabrielle, I'll take the first piece of your question, because this is something that comes up an awful lot, whether we're talking about immigration of physicians or immigration of any high-skilled group. There's always a concern that has been voiced that opening up the borders of the United States or liberalizing entry, expanding visas, for example, for those with high skills will result in what people have called a brain drain. That people with skills, people with abilities that are in high demand in developing countries will say, you know what, I'm going to take my skills, I'm going to leave Namibia, I'm going to leave Kenya, and I'm going to go to the United States. And consequently, you're going to make those home countries far worse off. And I think that's a very legitimate and important concern. Research to date, however, has suggested that there might actually be an opposite phenomena that's going on. Let's assume that getting a medical degree in your country allows you or provides you a ticket to go to the United States. And let's assume that people in a particular country, let's say Kenya or Namibia, want to come to the United States. What the research shows is that that will increase the probability that students in that country will obtain those higher degrees, will obtain those skills. It is not the case, though, that all of those individuals will leave the country and come to the United States. So having the opportunity or the ability to see that others from your country are going abroad because they have certain skills increases the desirability of those skills and actually increases the amount of skilled laborers or skilled individuals that are in your country. So the literature talks about what is actually a brain gain in the context of the ability of high-skilled individuals to migrate, not necessarily a brain drain.
Do you want to take on the Caribbean question or want to toss that to Sonal?
I want to toss it to Sonal.
So you're absolutely right. There are U.S. citizens, U.S. permanent residents who seek their medical training abroad, their medical education for whatever reason. And it's, again, analytically very helpful to us because we can hold constant whether or not somebody was trained outside of the United States and compare the outcomes of foreigners and Americans trained outside the United States. And so in terms of what we might describe as the quality metrics, the rate at which they're passing exams, the rate at which once they start practicing, their patient outcomes, their malpractice rates, so forth, so on, we have a hard time distinguishing between American medical graduates and foreigners who are foreign medical graduates. It's hard to tell much of a difference. But there is a pretty distinct difference between those two groups and the Americans who seek medical educations abroad. They tend to pass the exams at lower rates. They tend to have poorer patient outcomes. Here's the most striking statistic. So there is this centralized matching program for residency positions. Among U.S. medical graduates, over 90% receive a slot in this centralized system. As I indicated earlier, about 40% of foreigners who are foreign trained receive a slot. American citizens, permanent residents who are trained abroad, 50% of them receive a slot. We can ponder as to why that is, particularly given the first set of indicators that suggest that maybe they are not as well trained as those who are not U.S. citizens who were trained outside of the U.S. But they definitely are part of the picture here.
Specific to Gabriella's question, do you have a sense if most of those who are from the U.S. who get trained at a medical school outside our borders are going to the Caribbean, or are they going all over?
The Caribbean, Mexico, we also see. But yeah, by and large, I don't think they're going outside of the Western Hemisphere.
Gabriella, great questions. Thank you so much for calling us. We have a phone line open for you if you have thoughts about the intersection between medicine, immigration, and economics. That phone number is easy to remember as 888-WMRA-TALK. Got a question that you've not heard yet addressed, or a personal experience connected to our topic that you'd be willing to share? 888-967-2825. Next to Harrisonburg, Joe, thanks for calling us. Your question or comment, please.
Hi, I actually did want to respond to that question. That's why I called in. I'm originally from the Northern Virginia area, and I've been treated by a number of doctors who were foreign-born. And one in particular was a general practitioner at the office that I normally go to, and he was treating me for acid reflux. And I found him to be extremely knowledgeable in that area. And funny enough, I actually kind of wondered if he wasn't overqualified for the job, being sort of at a disadvantage, having gotten his education in Germany.
I'm curious, Joe, you're in Harrisonburg now. You used to be in Northern Virginia. This experience that you're telling us about a doctor who was apparently trained in Germany, did that happen in the Valley, or did that happen in Northern Virginia?
I was treated by the doctor in Northern Virginia.
Okay. And was this the first time that you had seen a doctor who seemed to be from outside the U.S.?
No, actually, on another occasion, I saw a dermatologist who was born in India and trained there. And it's funny, I mean, in a way, I almost think sometimes that a doctor I'm seeing who is foreign-born is actually possibly overqualified for the job, because I've read before about the, you know, more difficult barriers to getting a job as a medical doctor in the U.S. if you're trained outside the country. So in my experience, I haven't really had a bad experience with any medical doctors that were foreign-born. And in a way, I almost tend to see them as maybe more, you know, better at treating me, perhaps, which is maybe a little counterintuitive, I guess. But
so, Joe, your experience is really borne out by the data in the aggregate. So international medical graduates tend to concentrate in the primary care medical specialties. And it is the case.
Family docs.
Yeah.
Internists.
Right. Pediatricians. And it's likely because they trained in some other specialty, maybe a more advanced specialty in their home countries. But in order to practice that specialty in the United States would require a much lengthier residency. And so they perhaps are more inclined to complete the shortest possible residency and start practice right away. It is also the case that international medical graduates tend to be a little bit older on average than U.S. medical graduates. So, you know, they have families, whatnot, that they're particularly eager to start practicing.
Yeah, and Joe, it's a good. It sounds like a good experience. I mean, it would suggest that docs that have the sort of qualifications that Sonal is referencing and that you had experience with should actually put that in there, you know, in the phone book, right? You know, I have many more years of medical training than you know than an American trained graduate. Come and see me, you know, if they're competing for patients.
Right, and the one that I saw, I know he had a background in gastroenterology, so that's why he was particularly knowledgeable about being able to help me with my
right.
problem. But I know that he was a primary care physician in the U.S. And I always kind of assumed it was because of those more difficult barriers. So I really appreciate the discussion you guys had today.
Joe, thanks so much for sharing your experience with us. David LeBlanc is the J. Wilson Newman Professor of Governance at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, as well as chair of the university's Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics. Sonal Pandya is a faculty member in that politics department. Both are among the researchers who have produced a new report titled Doctors with Borders. David, you also have a third position at UVA with the Batten School?
Yeah, I'm on faculty at the Batten School of Public Policy and Leadership.
Talk about being overqualified.
Well, just lots of lines on your business card.
Sonal, was there something about what's going on in Virginia related to this issue that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, I think the numbers from our study might be of particular interest to your listeners. So in 2009, Virginia had a need of 106 physicians to remedy shortages in various parts of the state. By our calculations, were Virginia to equalize licensing rules for foreigners and U.S.-trained physicians, within 5 years, they could anticipate about 360 additional foreign physicians settling in Virginia. And again, this is based on our calculations. Were there to be that remedy of the physician shortage in the state of Virginia alone, we estimate about $164 million in annual savings due to unnecessary hospitalizations and the other costs due to a lack of access to primary health care. So really striking numbers.
So you grew up in a fairly urban area.
Yes.
Outside San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Your graduate work was done at Stanford.
I was an undergraduate at Stanford.
I'm sorry, undergrad is what I meant. And you spent some time in Germany, including an internship in Berlin at mm-hmm. the German Parliament. And then your PhD work was down outside Boston at a little school called Harvard. I understand that with all of this experience in different places in the world, that when it came time to consider coming to Virginia, you had a little bit of hesitancy. You didn't know much about the state. The area that you were coming to, you thought might be fairly rural and in the South. And somebody told you something, trying to reassure you.
So I have a friend who grew up in Covington, Virginia. And as I was talking to him about the possibility of moving to Virginia and expressing some doubt or some uncertainty about what it would be like, he said.
And you're of Indian ancestry.
Yes.
Your family is originally from the nation of India.
I was born in the United States. My parents were Indian immigrants that came in the first big wave of skilled immigrants in the mid-60s. So this friend of mine said, no, you don't understand. People in the South, particularly in the rural South, they love Indians. It's because all of the doctors in these areas are Indians. And so they're held in particularly high regard, apparently.
Well, you're smiling. Do you have something to say?
No, about I think it's a good story.
David LeBlanc,
it's
my understanding that this study that we've been focusing on about the integration between immigration and medicine and economic interests is actually just one of three studies that you all are currently working on that touch upon immigration issues. We've got just a couple minutes left, but do you want to tell us a little bit about the other two?
Yeah, so this paper really opened our eyes to the idea that immigration policy is, at least for the United States, is not something that occurs just at the national level. And when you look across states, there are lots of different regulations that influence the flow of foreign-born individuals across state borders. So Sol and I are just, with another graduate student of ours, Sarah Andrews, have just finished the first draft of a paper where we look at immigration and foreign direct investment across U.S. states. So we're trying to figure out how states compete with one another for international capital. A big part of that we find is their ability to attract or their ability to have skilled migrants, because skilled migrants from a particular country have information about investment opportunities that might come from those countries. And they also serve as a signal about the desirability of companies to locate in that particular state. This paper actually came up based upon a story that I heard on NPR, I think it was last February, about Alabama's new immigration law that was emphasizing self-deportation. And I believe it was the chairman or a high executive with Mercedes, was visiting a plant in Alabama. He had rented a car and didn't have his passport with him as he was driving to the plant, got pulled over. And because he didn't have his passport, he was put in jail. And I thought, wow, you know, if this sort of immigration policy is one where a company like Mercedes might say, you know, we're not so comfortable in Alabama, maybe this is going to have an effect on foreign direct investment. You know, the ability of these states to compete with one another for the kinds of capital that they really want. So that's one project that we're working on.
And I'm sorry, we're just about out of time. So I want to just address one last quick question to Sonal Pandya. It's my guess, Sonal, that the study that we focused most of the hour on, that you would hope perhaps that this is going to cause people to see immigration issues in a more nuanced way?
Yeah, to think about these state-level regulations as well as the national debate over immigration as being intertwined.
Our guests have been political scientist Sonal Pandya and David LeBlanc, both from the University of Virginia. The full study of the new study they helped create is Doctors with Borders, Occupational Licensing as an Implicit Barrier to High-Skilled Migration. David, Sonal, thank you both so much for making time for us.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you for having us.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, you will find links to more information about both of our guests and their new study. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.